Here at Physio Matters, we think physio matters. Become a member today and access over 500 webinars, get free tickets to shows and access new content instantly. Access at home, work or on the train to make sure your CPD is on track. Physio-matters.com. More content than the all-you-can-eat buffet cart.
Karen Middleton, welcome to Chewing It Over. On the eve of your retirement and, of course, vacating the position of CSP CEO, I want to start with what's gone well.
I think what's gone well is the modernisation of the CSP, the organisation. There's further to go, but I think what I leave behind is an organisation very different from the organisation that I inherited, and better. I think what's gone well is the influence of the CSP nationally, internationally. And I think what's also gone well is the profile of physiotherapy and physiotherapists and support workers, the entire physio family, really. Because I think we are now a profession that is externally focused rather than too internally focused. I think as a profession, we're regarded really positively and solution focused. I think individuals are regarded as leaders, both of the profession and within the healthcare sector. And I feel like, and maybe this is just sort of rose-tinted spectacles looking back, but I feel like the profession, the membership has come together now. When I think back to when I started, and I was joking with one or two members at my retirement do of the list of people that I was left that I shouldn't make contact with. You weren't on it, Jack. I don't think we knew you then.
But
some people you know were on it. And they were essentially in the independent sector. And they were, many of whom were my friends, which I found deeply ironic. And I think, you know, I did that founder's lecture when I talked about, you know, how all these arguments about whether it's hands on, hands off, and it all felt terribly insular and inward looking. And I feel that a mature organisation, a mature profession has to be able to have debate, and it has to be really challenging as well. But I think we've sort of tipped into something more constructive. And I think the profile of the profession has gone well. And I think COVID helped, sadly, but I think COVID did help. When I hear physio students and why they decided to go into the profession was what they saw on television of physiotherapy around that time.
Right.
I know that, you know, a tragic time for many, but I think that it did do a service to the physiotherapy profession in the same way that physios did a huge service during that pandemic. So those are the things that I think have gone well. Yeah.
See, I thought that when you first mentioned the pandemic there, I wondered if you meant it was useful for some internal reforms, because obviously system changes were mandated, weren't they?
It was. I mean, we were doing a lot of modernising of systems and processes before the pandemic. I mean, you know, we went virtual the day that we had to go virtual on the 23rd of March. We didn't drop a service at the CSP. I'm not saying we got everything right, but we did not drop a member service. And that was as a result of the work that had started a couple of years before, enabling everything to go on the cloud. We'd already started the work to look at moving from Bedford Row. And of course, there was a lot of resistance from staff because it's, for many people, where they've always worked.
Yeah.
And concern about where we might end up working, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, that really enabled us to move that much faster than we would have done otherwise. And, you know, looking to work in a hybrid way, more flexibly. All of that came as a result of the pandemic. And you know, sometimes you need those things to create that shift. And you think about the profession, you know, it sort of came into its own after World War One, and then really rehab took off World War Two. And I sort of think COVID pandemic probably had a significant impact.
There were a lot of battle and war metaphors, weren't there, in around that time, and sort of hunkering down. And I can understand that. And I think that the use of the sort of rehabilitation metaphor that emerges from that is a fair one, both for systems and then of course for healthcare, which remains of course in the wake of it. You famously, two things that were famous about it: the phrase, and then your irritation with the phrase when it kept getting caught back to you for too many years. But you said we mustn't sleepwalk into obscurity.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a cracking line. And then later on, you sort of ended up being a bit irritated to some extent because it hung around for longer because you felt that we had made progress more than that line was suggesting, you know. So just can you talk through what it was you were observing then and at what point you felt that that had become a dated phrase?
Well, I think the reason that I was so irritated enough to coin that phrase was that I came to the CSP, albeit I'd been a member for all my working life. I came to the CSP as one of its stakeholders. So, you know, I was the most senior allied health professional in England. And, you know, working for a government, working for the Department of Health, then NHS England, and knew how the CSP was regarded. And of course, if you know, you know, I was a physio and am a physio, so you know, I had skin in the game, and you know, I found it really difficult when, you know, oh, it's the typical CSP again, you know, negative, anti-change, resistant, and I was particularly irritated because, you know, I could see that the sort of the demographic and the context for healthcare was such that physio could be the solution to so much of all of this. And so it was the sort of irritation as a stakeholder that got me to that place. And then when I came to sort of a CEO, you know, the relentless arguing about, you know, really ridiculous small things when there was this massive context out there, was what was worrying me. And I thought,
so it was like none of it could feel to matter if the reputation didn't get improvement, right? That's how you sort of saw it at that civil service level, and you were fairly well qualified to observe that, right?
And I thought, you know, if we're not careful here, you know, we're going to be sort of squabbling away in one room, whether it's hands on, hands off, independent sector versus the NHS. I mean, you know, on and on and on it goes.
Yeah.
While out there, they've developed a new profession that's off and running. You know what I mean? And that's what I meant, that we could literally sleepwalk into our own oblivion. And it was a call to arms, really. It was also, I mean, you know, it was I was invited to give the founders lecture before I applied for the job.
Right.
And then I sort of thought, once I was a member of staff, I probably couldn't do it. And Natalie at the time said, well, I don't see any reason why not. I mean, it was probably more that they, you know, God, if we've got to find someone else to do it at this short notice. But anyway, so I did do it. And I thought, right, this is going to be my manifesto then. And I have never, ever taken so long or so much thought over a presentation before, to the point that I actually read it, because I was sort of, I really wanted to make sure I got my point across. And, you know, and so the point, so it irritated me in that, you know, every time I did an interview or Q&A or anything, people was asked me, what do I mean? I mean, to the point that I started saying, what do you think I meant? You know,
But, and I think that I was understanding as well of the fact that you weren't like really bristly on it for ages. It was more that enough years go by that then it starts to become an accusation that we're still on that track. What's changed? And I understood as to why. I think one of the things that, and I really do mean this tongue in cheek, by the way, but when you then years later said, I'm updating this because it's getting quarter back to me. And I think we've made so many significant reforms, especially internally. You were referring and able to list them. You were frustrated, and but it did feel like when Donald Trump was looking to rerun, he was like, do we go on Make America Great Again? Or do we, you know, it was like this, how much do, because we want to also imply that we've made significant changes. So he was torn between the call to arms and the acknowledgement of success.
Yeah.
So again, I do mean that tongue in cheek. I certainly am not calling you Trumpian in that regard. But good. I just wondered if then you were then and are now sort of in this situation where you still want to keep those two things in hand. There is still work to do, but then also there's a want to acknowledge what has been changed since you said that.
I think there has been enormous change, as I said earlier, around less of the internal focused sort of squabbling. And you know, we you were at the last council meeting. You know, there's some big topics that came up there. And you know, and it's clear to me that you will go on to discuss those big strategic issues. And I think that is exciting. I feel envious not to be witnessing some of that. So I think that as a profession, that has changed. And I think, you know, it was almost there just before COVID. But I think that COVID, the pandemic sort of had such an impact, didn't it, on all of us in all of aspects of our lives, that, you know, you start to sort of think there's bigger and more important things here. So I think, you know, and I always said the job of change within the CSP, the organisational development that I needed to do, would take at least 5 years. And I remember when I'd been here 5 years, and it was just before the pandemic, and I just thought, my job is not done. My job is not done. My intention had always been to retire at 60, but to have another CEO post after the CSP. But none of my career plans have ever gone as I intended them ever. So, but I knew at 5 years that my job wasn't done. And also that there wasn't that tipping point for the profession. There wasn't the confidence that I now see. So a really good illustration to me of the confidence of the profession is the attitude towards other professions, particularly in the MSK world, for example, where, you know, there's sports therapists, other therapists. And there was a time when, you know, there was such anxiety about these people. And I can remember saying, there's enough work for everyone. You know, we can't have it that there isn't enough people to deal with this demand and this need. And then there are others that can do it, and we're not happy for that. And I think, you know, the work, I think the project is called Collaboration, Not Competition, that we've done recently. And I think that is a great stepping stone to something more, because it seems to me that the profession is now confident in its own identity to then be able to collaborate with others and not see it as a competition and therefore have to get defensive. I think, you know, the issue between the independent sector and the NHS, there's room for all. You know, it's not lost on me. People talk about, you know, Ish, our first black chair. He's also the first independent sector chair. You know, I mean, when I started at the CSP, you know, we had an independent sector representative, because remember, it was a representative council at the time. I think there might have been one, there might have been two. And it was very, very tense, very difficult. And now we've got independent sector chair, you know, which I just think brilliant. You know, Ash, who I appointed, I didn't appoint him because he's from the independent sector, director of practice and development. To my knowledge, he's the first director from the independent sector.
Yeah, probably.
You know,
yeah.
And so there's so many signs of a confident profession. And I think that, I mean, gosh, there is so much more to do. And part of me feels really envious of John Cowman coming in, because I just think, you know, God, you've got such a plan. I'm not saying everything's right. I'm not. He's got, you know, there's lots still to do. But, you know, there's a really confident platform, I think, from the organisation and the profession. And, you know, I just hope that it's, you know, it's just going to keep building, and recognizing, particularly the organization, that the change, you know, when I started talking about change at the beginning, I was just talking to a member of staff here who was there at the beginning, and she was saying, oh God, you know, it's just like, oh, this woman keeps going on about the change that we need to see and all this business. And she said, and I've just learned that, you know, we've just got to keep evolving. And you know, that is so true. Keep evolving.
It does feel like an evolution and a maturing. Yeah. I think it's one of the things where some things, you know, there's some things that I'm coming to the organisation relatively fresh, council about a year and a bit now. And I've asked questions, I think, in recent council, you know, why would we do differently? You know, of course we'd be outward looking, and of course we'd not be threatened by a few, you know, if anything, we want to overlap and raise standards for healthcare. And then be like, believe me, you know, fair play. Rob smirks and said, trust me, there's been times where council have said the opposite. And you know, I'm looking around the room to see, and everyone's sort of like, no, of course, like fronting it up. And that feels nice as a culture shift.
It's brilliant.
On that, with regards to, when you then set about, right, let's not sleepwalk into obscurity. Let's set about a reformative agenda. Obviously, speak, you know, music to my ears, and it's certainly a call to arms that I heard and many others did, that then did inspire a generation of people to engage in lots of different ways. But from what I recall, because it wasn't that much after, not that long after that, that I interviewed you for Physio Matters. And from what I could gather from that, both listening back to it as well as from my memory, is that you'd set about looking on at what would then course correct some of the things you were concerned about. And you saw internal reform, organizational reform, as being really primary foundations for said reputational lift. And so I wonder if I could just get your thoughts on did you underestimate that by time frame, by extent, etc.? How do you feel that that's gone? And what parts of that do you feel might still remain?
Yeah, So I came to the CSP, and I know I was recruited to the CSP because of my external networks. You know, I was the chief allied health professions officer. You know, I think people thought I was, you know, had a hotline to the Secretary of State for Health, you know, and all of this carry on. And, you know, and that's what, believe you me, that's what I loved doing. But I've got a great belief in the organisation finds you and you find the organisation. Bearing in mind, I never in a million years did I plan to come and work at the CSP, because I definitely had a love-hate relationship with it. But my master's was in organisational development, a psychoanalytic approach. Right. And I can't tell you what I found. I mean, I talked about it at my retirement do. I mean, it was just a disaster zone. And yet, what I did find was a whole load of really talented people, but I didn't know any of them. I'd never met any of them. I'd never seen any of them. I'd only ever really met the CEO and perhaps the deputy CEO. And I just thought, so my job is to enable this talent to shine. And so where I thought I would be the one who was out and about, you know, doing all the influencing, I decided what I needed to do was to create the organisational environment to let the staff to be able to go out and do all of this. And, you know, and I talked before about, you know, watching Newsnight with my husband during the industrial action, and Elaine Sparks, the assistant director, not Claire Sullivan, not me, the CEO, nor the chair, but Elaine Sparks on Newsnight. And my husband saying to me, shouldn't that be you? And I said, but isn't it marvellous how brilliant that it's Elaine? She was in the negotiations. She was in the room with Steve Barclay. So she should be on Newsnight. Not in some recognition of her and what she'd done, but because she was the person who had the
closest
most knowledge,
to the expertise,
course,
yeah, rather than
course,
her briefing you
of
and
course.
Claire, yeah.
And you know, seeing Sarah Hazard just run with the rehab agenda, you know, is just fantastic. So I knew that it was an organisational development job. I knew that there were systems and processes that were there that weren't there. And I do remember, I think it was about 2.5 years, no, maybe less than that, about 18 months, 2 years in, and my husband saying to me, are you ever going to come home and not tell me of some other hideous thing that you've discovered? And it was like every stone I turned over, there was something else.
Right.
And I mean, there was a point where I was so, I just needed a break from all of this. And bearing in mind, I also had people around, you know, and it was very hard because people were working hard. And yet here was this person coming in and saying, but this isn't right. This isn't right. This isn't right. It was one thing after another. So it was harder than I thought. Would I do anything different again? Absolutely. Yes, I would. But hindsight's a wonderful thing. And I think that I mean, this is going to sound arrogant. This is going to sound arrogant, and I don't know how else to say it, but I'm just glad it was me because I did have the OD experience. And also I was a physiotherapist, and that enabled me to do a lot of things and say a lot of things, particularly around the governance review, that I'm not sure the profession would have accepted from someone who wasn't a physiotherapist. So it was a lot. It took a big personal toll on me, which is why in many ways, and again, this is difficult, but in many ways, leading the organisation through the pandemic was one of the easiest things I've ever done, because we had one job. I had one job, just do whatever it takes to support our staff to work from home in order that they support our members. It's supporting our members, you know, and we sat down.
So by that, so you're meaning that by that point, you felt you had an apparatus that you just needed to facilitate their
and
support.
And also I didn't, everything else could just pale into significance. And I remember sitting down with the directors and I'm saying, right, we need to think about how we're going to approach this. And, you know, we talked about command and control, and that is the sort of instinctive thing you do in this sort of VUCA world. And I said, no, this is going to be the ultimate test of what we've created at the CSP. And boy, did everyone step up. I mean, you know, and I know we didn't get everything right. I'm not in any way saying we did, but who did get everything right during COVID?
Well, we're learning more and more about that, aren't we? Of course,
exactly.
At the moment. And just out of interest, you've mentioned there about the fact that you're a physio by background, then being the CEO, which was the first time we'd done that.
Yeah.
Can you reflect on the pros and the cons of that?
Yeah.
Or do you recognise there being any cons?
So the advantage was that when I'm out with members, you know, there's almost not a member's experience that I haven't been through. Now, it might have been some time ago. But, you know, I have been a physio student. I have been, you know, first starting out in my job and, you know, and all of those. So when I'm talking to members, there's a connection that I can, it's almost instinctive. It's like, you know, when I walk into a staff room of physios and physio support workers, it's like coming home for me. I know the humour.
There's a familiarity.
I know the language. I know what they're thinking, you know. So for me, that made my life very easy from that point of view. And I think there was a connection. I think there was a massive advantage in me leading the organisation, because one of the things that I wanted to work on was, you know, developing leaders. And it struck me, all these messages that I've had about my retirement that have come in about me being a female leader, and what a thing that has been. You know, I never think about that so much, I have to say, but, you know, my staff, lots of other people have said being a woman and being in a CEO position, that's made a difference. So being a physio had lots of advantages. The disadvantages were that I needed to make sure, and I can remember saying at my interview when they kept going on about me being a physio, was, don't appoint me because I'm a physio. Appoint me because you think I'm the best CEO for the job. And so I had this sort of, there was almost a, it would add to the imposter syndrome. I'm only here because I'm a physio. It was tricky for me and the director of practice development. It was Natalie Beswetherick at the time, because my role had been professional, the professional advice, and she was the most senior physio in the country, if you like, until I came. So I had to very, very quickly make it clear that I would be out and about with members. But when it comes to advising on clinical issues, that is not me. And when I was at the department, I would come to people like Natalie for that advice. And I've said to you before, the other disadvantage is being out and about with members. They assume that I've got clinical knowledge and expertise that I really haven't. So there are advantages. I mean, with ministers and stakeholders, there is no doubt that being a physio and going into a room and saying, I'm a physiotherapist, makes the conversation change. It really does. Because you've got that, you've got some credibility that,
No, I can definitely understand that. I think that I'll just offer a bit of a reflection I've been considering myself on this, where wasn't so long ago, maybe a couple of years or so, where I really wondered if there was a time where I wondered if this was not by design or purposeful necessarily, but something that was more baked in than what I now observe, which is now I think it's something that is almost that there is a drawback that is worth us thinking about to you happening to be a physio as well by background. And currently, I know you retain your registration. But I'm just meaning that my thoughts now is that there is something that we've got to try to find a way to correct for where you have ended up. And I mentioned this in the podcast we did years ago, is that there is a process where, well, Karen is, we've grown our own, and therefore she becomes the best of us, both symbolically and that reputation as to having come through the ranks in different things. And it's regularly referenced in various contexts in the CSP that you used to be a steward and all those sorts of things, right? So you've been there. But then it means that then if you didn't have those instincts, then naturally there would have been an inherent engagement exercise that meant that then the organization would have to reach through a variety of channels for further engagement. And so, as I say, more cynically, a few years ago, I was thinking that were by design, and that to some extent, my being involved more in the CSP in recent times and on council has helped me to realize that I think that I still consider that a problem. And I've been vocal with you. It's no surprise to you that I feel this way, but also to our audience, it's not that I do see that as being a real challenge that the CSP needs to front up to. However, I think that I'd be wrong to suggest I think that's detached completely from the fact that you happen to be a physio, and that there's been an institutional complacency over that, in part because part of your leadership has to have had that instinct and those priors that, just naturally are going to come for the ride. And so they should, because they have their upsides. But I just think that as we look forward, when we appointed John, it was a nice to have that that happens to be in his background. Doesn't have his license, but happened to be a physio. But it wasn't essential because realistically, I think that it has got its drawbacks too.
No, and I mean, you will be interested. Well, I don't know whether you know, but so some time ago, this was before I announced my retirement and everything. I can't remember who I was in discussion with, but it was someone on council. And there was a conversation about when I leave, and you look around all the other physios and who's it going to be? And I just sort of had to say, oh, hang on a minute. Why would you limit your pool to just the physiotherapy profession? And secondly, I'm not sure that when I go, the organisation or the council should be looking for a physio. And it was like the person I was talking to, I can remember, was quite shocked at this. And then when I spoke to Ish about my retirement, before, I mean, this was before it was announced. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, you know, Ish, this will be your decision, and obviously you'll want to discuss it with council, but I would strongly, strongly advise you not to limit the pool to only physiotherapists, which many other professional bodies have done. Yeah, not right. to physiotherapists, but, you know, the RCN, you have to be a registered nurse, for example.
To be their CEO.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but yeah.
Yeah, and there are others. So, I said, you know, I strongly advise against that. And I said, you know, I'm going to have no part to play in this recruitment whatsoever. But I said, I actually think, I mean, you obviously can't rule out physios from applying. No. But I said, I'm not sure that the next CEO should be a physio at all. I feel really content about retiring, partly because I'd always planned to do it at 60, and partly because I know it's right for me, but I also know it's absolutely the right time for this organization. It needs something different and someone different. Now, the other thing about, you know, running an organization is, yes, I've got expertise in OD, but for example, I think the next really big phase for the organization is a much harder drive, as you know, from council, on digital transformation, on data-informed work, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I am right behind supporting, because I think this is the right direction. But it's hard for me. It's hard for me. I have to understand stuff before I can really get behind it. And that whole area, you know, it takes me longer to understand it than I think is needed. So I'm not saying that physios don't have those digital transformation skills, but I don't. And
it's a fair enough thing. It is a very technical discipline in lots of ways, and the moving parts and how the jigsaw comes together in that sort of space.
But on the other hand, you recruit people who are brilliant. I mean, one of the things that I am sort of proudest about, whenever anybody's talking about, you know, what we've achieved and all the rest of it, and I think actually my part in it is that I recruited these people. You know, I've not done it. I've recruited them. And you know, I didn't recruit Rob. I didn't recruit Natalie, but other than those, you know, Claire, John, Ash, I recruited, and I would have recruited Rob if I'd been able to have done so, but he was already here. And I just think, look at the talent, and in all of their areas, they know more, are better than me, and I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Did you do enough? Have you done enough to counter the Queen Karen narrative?
The Queen Karen narrative. I mean,
you might feel free to just disagree that either exists or is relevant.
I've never even heard that phrase for a start.
Well, I made it up just now.
But I know but what
I think you
mean.
Can understand what?
Yeah,
I'm
I know what you mean. I mean, I think the problem is, I mean, it was like I was having a conversation with someone this morning. I got a book of comments from people for my retirement. And I said, you know, I find it astonishing how many people have mentioned the first time they met me and how formidable I am and how scary I am and all of this stuff. And I said, you know, I just don't recognize those words. I just simply don't recognize those words. And it's a bit like that with Queen Karen or whatever you mean. You know, I'm just doing my job. When I went to be Chief Allied Health Professions Officer in England, and then I moved to the CSP, there was quite a lot of commentary about downwards, sideways, certainly not an upward move. Why would you? And I just said, but I don't really think of those things. It's the job that I want to do. it's the job that I think I can make a difference at. And I've banged, you know, before I came here, I banged on long enough about the CSP and what, you know, what it needed to do and shouldn't do and should do, you know, go in and try and do something about it. So I don't really recognize it, but I do have an ego like everyone else. And there is no doubt that it's nice to be recognized. It's nice to be known. But I can honestly say to you, absolutely hand on heart, that as long as that can make a difference to where the organisation is and where the profession is, that's, at the end of the day, job done for me. And if it means, you know, putting on that crown every now and then, so be it.
Yeah, well, in the spirit of my question, it's that I remembered when we'd spoken on the podcast the first time, where it had come up where I'd sort of challenged some of that, where people had said like the part of their professional highlights reel was that they shared a cab with you once and stuff, right? They were kind of deifying you a bit.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I'd forgotten that specific story until I listened to the podcast back. But that's kind of what I'm meaning. And,
yeah.
And then it kind of speaks to the fact that, again, referencing that podcast, me and you had a back and forth where we clearly disagreed as to the rate of change and things. And you quite understandably said to me, look, this thing's going on behind the scenes. You're just going to have to trust. But what I'm not saying, Jack, is come back to me in 5 years. I agree with you. It needs to move faster than that. Now, there weren't any specifics, and it's not as if I'm here with any sort of gotcha, but it's just that one of the things that I think is sort of, I would say, been central to mine in your relationship, for want of a better term, over the years, is that it's been this art of the possible that has been challenging, that I've been sort of the utopian of which you might agree with in principle on some things, but fundamentally there's a rate of change that any organization and any culture can tolerate, and that if only you knew, Jack. And to be fair, that has been persuasive to me in lots of ways, and I've given what I feel was hopefully an appropriate space to both you and the organization over time. There's people on our audience that have been irritated at that, what they consider me backing off. There's been others that feel like I've always been too aggressive.
Yeah.
And I'm not here to please anyone, just as you haven't been. However, in the spirit of that, I just wonder if we can just have a back and forth about the fact that then, if as you're now retiring, do you feel that the calls for more rapid change were naive? Or no, I don't just mean by me. I mean, you've heard it from others. Or is it that fundamentally has been something that you hoped things would be able to move faster because of those internal reforms that you'd done, that if ideally we'd be further ahead? I know the pandemic, et cetera, there's lots of factors. But I wonder if you can just reflect on that timeline and the changes that you feel could have happened at what pace?
Yeah, I think, remember, it was my first CEO job.
Right.
And I think if I'd been a CEO before, I would have recognised a lot of the stuff, possibly, that I found that I was sort of in complete shock over. I think what is really hard, and it's very interesting talking to John Kalman about this, is it suddenly dawns on you when you're chief executive of a membership body that you're not in charge. I know that sounds like really obvious to you, and it sounds so obvious to me now, but he had a moment in talking with me when he realised that. And I definitely had a moment when I realised that after I'd been appointed. And I think that, you know, if John comes in and he wants to, I mean, I don't know what he's going to do, but if he wants to make some significant changes, you know, one of the things I keep saying to him is you've got the counsel that you need to be able to do that. Now, Ish and I, in our conversation with him, we're talking a bit about this and yesterday, and I was saying, this is the first council that hasn't got any members on it that either were or were steeped in what I regard as the sort of long history of the CSP. So one of the issues with the governance review, one of the big changes was the length of tenure of council members and the length of tenure of committee members, and how you can't just sort of be on a committee, then go on council, then come back to a different committee, then go back up on council and all of that anymore. You can't. But then it was like the same people going round and round and round. Now, what I need to be clear on is those people were giving of their time voluntarily. They passionately believed in physiotherapy and the CSP, and they were staunch advocates for us. You know, and many of them had done really amazing things for the profession. But the reason that I think that that the council now and the difference you can make, given you haven't been exposed to those people, is because you haven't got that sense of, oh, but, you know, it's always been done that way, or we'd be letting those people, the good and the great, down. Do you know what I mean? You and your colleagues are your own sort of people. And I think
we're less constrained by precedent, for sure.
Yeah,
I think that one of the
that's
things
the word I'm looking for. Less constrained by precedent.
Good. I'm glad. I rarely clarify things. I'm usually the one.
No,
that's
I mean, I think
it,
so. You are, but also, but I think that, you know, the governance review, you know, the actual changing of the structures, changing of the size, changing, you know, all of that was one thing, and the rules and regulations and everything. But the behaviours and everything else had to come afterwards. And Alex McKenzie was a fantastic chair at that transition point. And then, of course, we had COVID, which, you know, just, you know, buggered it up for everyone, really. But I do think that this council is the first of the modern era, if you like. That's how I describe it.
And so just for those that are listening in that might not understand exactly the obvious sort of distribution of powers as it exists, is the executive, of which is the member of staff run by the chief exec, are to operate the organisation and to run that off a strategy that is then run by the council, and a strategic set of documents that then they would to be deployed. And that is something that obviously I got to know more when I was looking at running for council for election, and then obviously being in amongst it. What's your sort of general assessment as to how well that split of powers works as of now? I can understand where it's come from, but I mean as of now.
I think so the reason it's like that is because we're a trade union and we're governed by trade union legislation, which means the governing body has to be from the elected members. So we can truly say we're member led. Now, you'll be familiar with the members that write in, ring in, email, whatever, you know, about council decisions and not agreeing with the council decisions. Well, you know, that's the downside of democracy, isn't it, really? That's what you get. I think it's absolutely right. And, you know, what I was trying to do with the governance review was ensure that, you know, the council was holding the chief exec to account. And if the chief exec was mad or bad, that the council could deal with it, rather than all decisions coming to the CEO, because then it wasn't member-led. It appeared to be member-led, but it wasn't. I know now it is, you know, it is absolutely member-led. Now, however, you know that the papers that are written for council are written by people who are experts in those areas, and so to inform council, but the decisions are always council's, and there has to be a consensus because people will have different opinions on council. But ultimately, I think it works really well. I think it is, you know, I've always described, and Mike Hudson, who does all the governance work, you know, describes the executive and the council as a Venn diagram with an overlap in the middle. You know, essentially council is there for strategy, and essentially the executive under me is there for the operation, but there's definitely an area of overlap. And then the four committees are there to inform council on detailed areas of work. I think it can be hard for the executive and it can be hard for council. I think the issue about council is we could get anyone, you know, with loads of experience or no experience. Do you know what I mean? It's not like the executive, which is paid and appointed and assessed against a whole load of criteria.
It needs to be safe by design in the way in which we can create it. And if we go on to create precedent that suits the people in the room now, then that's not going to be good for the security of the legacy that then needs to be created. So it does need to be thoughtful in that regard.
It does need to be thoughtful.
Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, and you know, and I suppose this was quite a shock for me when I came, was, you know, the diversity, and I don't mean the protected characteristics because we haven't got that diverse a profession at all, but in terms of where people are at and what they think is as diverse as the population. You know, any assumption.
It's a really good mixed bag for ideas. That's definitely the case. In the council of which I sit, for all that we can be accused of and people enjoy accusing us, there's plenty of diversity of views. There's a healthy debate between us, often ahead and after meetings, etc., but also within it, and we're all fronting that up. So I'm glad you've spotted that, because I certainly feel that way. I feel like people are heard, and the members are heard through us in that way.
Yeah.
If I made you queen earlier in the conversation, if I made you headmistress for a second, and you had to give a sort of exam score to, let's just take this particular issue first, if I can. If you were to sort of score the function of those powers, the executive and its council, what would you give it as a sort of grade?
What, this council?
Yeah.
I'd say...
And particularly as it speaks to the function, yeah, it supports the organisation.
I would say 8 out of 10. I would say that it's taken this council a while. And I think that... And I think that's partly sort of circumstance. You know, Alex, the previous chair, was a chair for 4 years. So a very experienced chair. And so those who'd worked under Alex or been on council under Alex, you know, this, you know, a new chair who was also new on council, albeit Ish had been co-opted to council. And so, you know, a new chair, I think, probably, I don't know the answer to this, but I think probably the youngest council that I've been involved with. And I think that brings with it some real positives, but it also brings, you know, that sort of experience or wisdom of years. You know, you've got that tension between the two. What I would say, so I think that it's taken a while for the council to come into its own, but, you know, I said to my staff, the directors, you know, what a way to end, you know, my last council meeting with a council that I thought, yes, you know, there's some big issues here. They've spotted the big issues. They want to debate some of this stuff now. And so I think that, you know, I wouldn't mind betting it will be 9, 10 out of 10 next year.
I'm glad
I think
trajectory.
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, I don't know whether you feel it being on council, but I felt there was conversation between the executive and the council. It wasn't a challenge defensive reaction either way. It was conversation, different.
Yeah, no, it did. It definitely did feel that way. I think it's interesting because, you know, I've my own style, which no one should ever emulate, but obviously a sort of famously confrontational person. It's what made me a podcaster in the first place in lots of ways. But then also the minute that that's done, it's only as a means of providing some energy, because then it's all about collaboration.
Yeah.
But then one of the things that's been fascinating for me to observe and for us to try and aspire to ongoing is the way in which we can then have an organization at large that can then really respond to the claim that it's not acting for members. So what are the routes to people doing it? Because that's one of the things that we're all facing all the time on various issues, where why doesn't the CSP do X? Insert, why doesn't CSP say more about Y, right? And it's just that tends to be the extent of many members' engagement. Now, it's within their rights to do so. You pay your subs. You know, I've never been one to say that it's like, well, you know, so you can't grumble about the potholes unless you run for council, and you can't grumble about the CSP unless you run for its council. So, you know, that's definitely not why I stepped forward recently. It isn't just because it's like I've been whinging, I better do something. It's definitely more that I felt like it was a useful time for me to lend myself. But when it comes to those sorts of things, you must have had all sorts of range of emotions over when people have said that, myself included, over the years. Why don't the CSP do insert thing or do more? We have had really interesting challenges recently whereby then you've got to make sure we speak as one voice, but also for some education of the membership to understand how decisions are made and the responsibilities and trade-offs that a council and the executive need to make. As an employer, as a union, as a professional body, the practice-based implications, as well as the reputational consequences and all the complexity that comes from that diplomacy. So I just wondered, it's useful for me and you to be on the same show, in a sense, for us to be as council and executive to sort of reflect on that, because recently we've had a powder keg of that example, and those sorts of things can sometimes be an opportunity for us to sort of share those reflections, especially as you're leaving.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I can definitely say, I mean, I think I said to John Cowman in one of our handover meetings, you know, you can please some of the members some of the time. I think that, you know, I'm sure that we could do more and do better to explain a lot. But actually, you know, most members really don't want more stuff from us. And I think we have to be careful at spending all our time trying to explain ourselves and not just getting on and doing and working on behalf of our members. And I'm a strong believer in the work should speak for itself. I think that what we have to be careful of as an executive, and therefore council have to be careful of, is that the members you hear from, it is very easy, and let's be honest, I only really hear from members when they want to complain about something. Until you retire, actually, people suddenly start telling you, you know, all the things that you've done that's great. But at the time, it's always
I'll do a fake retirement.
Yeah, just do a fake retirement. And you have to be careful to listen or to read or whatever, what's being said, but be careful not to be knocked off course by the latest rant or disagreement with your decision or whatever. Now, you know, you should definitely be, you know, and I have learned this. I mean, I have learned, you know, way back, you know, I'd get a tirade of stuff that would come in and I'd run around the organisation thinking, right, we need to, you know, obviously, and then somebody would say, it's four members, Karen. It's four members. We've got 65,000. You know, like, let's just, you know, wait. And of course, the members that write in, and particularly when they feel very strongly about something, if there's an emotional element to that, I mean, it's like the whole echo chamber thing that you know, they probably have tested it out with, you know, their friends, their colleagues, who probably feel the same, because we all tend to socialise with people who feel the same. Look on social media, see the same views as they hold, because that's who you follow and all the rest of it. And then there's an assumption that the entire membership think this.
Yeah.
And you have to be really careful to listen, to think, to reflect. I mean, for example, you know, the Gaza-Israel scenario, which, you know, I observed council reflect, consider, discuss. I mean, we went way over time because it was such a serious subject. It's so important to many members. But some of the most vocal members appear to be talking on behalf of the membership. And of course, what council and certainly myself and my staff are getting is members writing in saying, you're going too far. Why are you even having anything to do with this subject? You're a professional body, you're a trade union. It's got nothing to do with employment rights or professional practice. And anyway, you know, what difference does it make in the Middle East, what the CSP thinks anyway? You've got members who are feeling very pro-Palestine. You have members who feel very pro-Israel, and any mention of ceasefire is deeply political. And I watch council try to navigate this. And I am certain that all of them, all of you on council, will have had your own personal views and, for all I know, personal experience. And I think what I watched was a council come to a decision knowing that it wouldn't necessarily be popular with many, many members, but nevertheless took that decision, which was very brave, I think. I have no doubt that if you'd come to another decision and come down and made some different statement, we would have still had the emails, et cetera, et cetera. And I suppose what I find really, I feel for council about is you are a group of volunteers. You're not paid for this. You know, the abuse, et cetera, I get, you know, you could argue I'm paid to get it. You know, there are times when I just want to write back and say, you know, I'm a human being as well, don't you? But, yeah, you know, to a certain extent, I and my staff are paid to. You as volunteers are not. You have stepped up and do this work on top of your day job, which you will know is not easy to fit in. And you're trying desperately to make sense of one of the most complex situations that, let's be honest, those that are in positions of influence and are paid to try and resolve this issue in the Middle East can't do either. So do you know what I mean? I have absolute empathy with how council have had to navigate not just this situation, but many, many other situations which are hard. But the one thing that I am heartened by in all of this is that council is not ducking making these decisions, that the membership do feel they can express themselves. And let's be honest, you know, councillors have made yourself accessible to the members to be able to make direct contact with you. I have made myself accessible for members to be able to make direct access to me. So it's one of those things that, you know, I really admire this council and any council, actually, for taking up that leadership role, because it's a thankless task in many ways.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that would you be, because you've heard council this, you know, since I've been there, each meeting we've said that part of our hope is for an improvement in access, transparency, openness of comms, articulating what's going on in a different way, trying to be as to modernize, which coincides, of course, with the digital transformation needs internally of the organization. Do you feel that that is a direction of travel? Because you're in a position where you can just say, no, Jack, I think that's a bad call. Feel free to. But that has definitely been something that we've felt passionate about, is that the more we've looked at it, the more we've realized that some of the things that people are calling for us to do, we're often doing threefold, and that the ability to articulate that, granted, without distraction, you know, if you're just explaining it, you know, you're not doing it, I get that. But if we can communicate, or at least create access channels for more member engagement, and to boost those numbers for people that are electing, for people to feel like it's meaningful and worthwhile, for council decisions to be able to be seen, to that the members that they elected help make these decisions, whether you agree with them or not, but it is membership in action type stuff. Do you feel that that, as an agenda, for want of a better term, is a positive move?
Yeah, I do think it's a positive move. But I do think there's got to be some realism to it. And I say that because, you know, our election turnout is very similar to all other professional bodies. In many cases, it's higher. I think our members, you know, are swamped. So I'm not sure how many people do want all of that. And, you know, we've had numerous examples of where you do have stuff that's out there and is explaining and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, one of the most common things that we end up having to do all the time is, you know, actually we did do it, here it is, there it was, et cetera, et cetera. But people haven't looked or haven't found it or whatever. Now, you could argue, well, we're not making it accessible enough and we need to do it a different way. But short of sort of, you know, sending emails with all of this in, and nobody wants more emails, it's very difficult to know how. I do think
horse to water and make it.
Yeah, but I do think that that is an important part of the way.
I think one of the things, because I hear that, and I think it's a really fair point that governance have responded to us as council and to me as an individual at, when I look at those numbers. I think one of the reasons that I feel that there's something we could be ambitious, but it could be considered naive, I accept. But it's just that because we've got such a significant monopoly in that space compared to most organizations, that the capture, the density, is an interesting one, where the majority of UK physios that are registered are then chartered through being members of the CSP, means that then, and because of the influence it's increasingly carving, means that that then is a really important voice. And so to back that up means that we should, of course, we should be aspiring for double the normal turnout for an organization like that, because it's something that ends up having more clout. And it's not a Royal College tinkering with standards. And I'm not just saying that's all that Royal Colleges do, but by me understanding the organization in its fullest and witnessing what it's doing, it makes sense for me that then access, rather than if they don't take us up on it, but then we'd have better, it would feel less inherently defensive for us to say, look at these ample channels of which you're clearly consciously not engaging with, in order for us to then feel that then that is a horse to water, but I can't make you drink, rather than it being that to some extent people feel at times that it feels too detached because of the. And I would say that, I'll admit I'm projecting here, I'm not just being devil's advocate, I think that the apparatus of it always existing within a trade union context means that that's sometimes the only place in which people feel that they have really encountered it. And so therefore, when they don't necessarily feel that this is a trade union issue for their shop steward, they don't necessarily feel that they're engaged with the professional body or other aspects.
No, I mean, I think, and you know, what we've done a lot of work on over the years is, you know, the localism agenda and getting, you know, these virtual teams out across England in particular, in order so that it isn't just the CSP steward route into the professional body. And I mean, it's been great to see those networks grow and expand as the way into the CSP. I think the other problem, though, that we have with the membership, we don't have a problem with the membership. I think one of the issues for the membership is that You know, if I go back to some of the council decisions, you know, council isn't listening. Will be the start of an email or whatever. And often, I want to say, you know, council is listening, but you don't like the answer.
Yeah.
And that's you know, the adult to adult thing to be able to say. And one of the, you know, going back to where we started and the changes, one of the changes I wanted to see was I felt it was like a parent-child relationship with the membership. And, you know, people used to talk to me about the mothership being the CSP. And I used to think, God, that's really weird. I've never, ever thought of the CSP as the mothership. But I think we have a much more adult to adult relationship now. But that then means that both the CSP, and it's primarily the executive, has to hear some uncomfortable things, as do the membership have to hear some uncomfortable things. I think what the problem is, and you know, I found this when I first started engaging with the diversity networks, you know, they wanted to understand more about our governance, and you explain the governance, and it just sounds like bureaucracy trying to prevent their voice. But actually, what good governance is about transparency and being sure that decisions are being made properly and appropriately.
Well, checks and balances is a political phrase, but the reason that checks and balances can, you know, be important is for that there's a security, a layer of that. But then also, if you know, well, why should I be checked if I'm right? And why would we want balance if it's so clearly the right moral decision?
Oh, I mean, don't
made?
Get me wrong.
So people get frustrated by that, don't
no,
they?
No, and you know, one of the things that when I did the governance review, well, I mean, I didn't do it, but, you know, when we were working on the governance review, you know, a lot of focus was on the changes for the membership, okay? And I had to do quite a lot of work with actually what that would mean differently for the staff. And many staff will talk now about how they used to have so much contact with council, you know, and they don't get that contact now. Now, you know, there's a healthy contact and there's unhealthy contact. You know, unhealthy contact was, you know, council sort of having such a relationship with my staff that, you know, Jack Chu would tell a member of staff, do this, and they would say, yes, you know, of course I will, Jack, whether it was in the corporate strategy or not. You know, there was a lot of that going on, or staff trying to influence council. You know, that had to stop. Council is holding us to account. And now, you know, of course, there's no reason why council doesn't and can't have contact with my staff. But, you know, understanding the governance is really, really important, I think. And often it's more important in case things go wrong. Not
absolutely. Well, and that's the thing, is that we've got to make sure we've got that credible trail
absolutely.
For decision making, and that there is a thoroughness to that. It's a large and important organization that's trying to punch above its weight, then we need to make sure it's credible.
Yeah.
And that it's scratched beneath the surface, you don't find it wanting. I'm really sorry, I've just looked at the time and we've been past what I've so have you got 5 more minutes, or should we need to
literally 5 though, because I've got meeting at half 2.
So do I better go and see a patient. I'm sorry, I didn't realize we'd gone so over time. But yeah, let's wrap up. One thing that I did want to make sure I mentioned, because it seems really relevant to within COVID, is a member of staff at the CSP had said to me that whilst they happened simultaneously, she'd said that despite that her reflection was that even though we're a healthcare associated body, the death of George Floyd was as influential at that time on the organization as the pandemic was, and they happened at the same time, and you could never separate all of those things off. But how so, and what do you see as being the future for the organization in that direction, in an important cultural
issue? Yeah, I mean, at my retirement due, because I had two, an internal one and an external one, for want of a better word, but every time I went near this subject, I broke down. And the reason is because it was such a painful time for me personally, but also for the organisation, because I think it required an acknowledgement and an apology, personal apology, as well as a sort of corporate apology for what we hadn't done. and for what we'd missed. And there was work on equity, diversity and inclusion, but it was invisible, below the radar, and you know, you just, it just wasn't there. And I think that when I think back, you know, in the same way that I think COVID was, I was clearly focused, knew what we had to do. The murder of George Floyd and the acceleration of Black Lives Matter and then the development of our EDB strategy, I have never, ever felt so at sea about what to do on a very personal level. And yet, you know, as chief exec, I mean, I couldn't wobble. So whilst I didn't know what we were going to do or how we were going to do it, I knew that we had to do something really, really important. And, you know, thankfully, the diversity networks, many, many staff, and many colleagues and members sort of moved us forward on developing that strategy. You know, again, many mistakes made. And, you know, sometimes I thought, God, we'd take two steps forward and one step back. But we did develop a corporate strategy. We have embedded those objectives within, we did develop an EDB strategy. We've embedded those in now the corporate strategy. We are seeing some tiny, tiny signs of change. I think, you know, and again, in my handover to John Cowman, I've stressed to him that this is the most significant thing for our profession now in terms of the diversity of membership. But equally, I mean, you know, something I said at my retirement, you know, we're having conversations now that are really hard, but we would never have had them before. There would never have been that voice for some of our most marginalized groups of members to be able to speak out and speak up. And of course, it's uncomfortable, it's difficult, but that doesn't mean to say it shouldn't happen. And I think that the profession has got a long way to go. I mean, you know, we talk about emails from members and stuff. I mean, some of the things that I get sent to me are so disturbing and so, you know, I mean, I can't even believe that they're part of our profession. But why should our profession be any different from society at large, I suppose?
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because I think we sometimes do. There is this natural self-selection that occurs to the, you know, we are by nature a set of professionals. Therefore, there's a threshold there in lots of different ways from the way in which you've selected into it. You've selected into a healthcare profession, which does.
Yeah.
So you end up making, there are some reasonable priors to make as to why.
I think so.
However, with regards to the breadth of culture and economic views as to why that wouldn't then map onto someone's politics means that you're going to have a major breadth there, including people that are very obnoxious over important social issues.
And particularly, I mean, you know, think about the future of the profession and really, you know, we're reflecting back, but, you know, what's the future? People. You know, if I have to keep listening to students, Black and minority ethnic students and their experience, not from their universities, but on placement with their practice educators, physiotherapists, it's outrageous. It is completely and utterly outrageous what they experience. And so while that is continuing, you know, we've got a massive job to do, massive job. And, you know, I really do think that, you know, COVID, the murder of George Floyd, you know, in my sort of tenure have been the two big events, really.
They came together in so many ways, and then they
will transform the profession going
interesting,
forward.
Right. Well, so I've got one more minute. So tell me a little bit about what you've got planned for your retirement. I don't think I've heard that question answered yet.
So I'm
joining council is what I just assume. I'll give you a year and then
absolutely
you can join me on council.
Not. I would never, ever want to join council. I could never do that job. I think that, I joked at my retirement due that I'm going to take a month just to lie in bed and read books. I do need a break. I haven't ever had a gap year, maternity leave. In fact, I had to get a doctor's certificate recently and I didn't know how to do that because I'd never had enough time off sick to warrant it. I am going to have a break. My husband retired a couple of years ago. We've got lots of travel plans. But I trained as an executive coach about 5 years ago. And I've been doing that work pro bono. I think I'm good at it. I really enjoy it. And I might pick that up on a more formal basis. I've never, unlike you, set up or run my own business or anything like that. So I don't quite know how I will go about it. But I've really enjoyed coaching within
Well,
healthcare, but in other sectors too. So.
no, that sounds exciting on the coaching side. But look, I know what you're hinting at, and I'm happy to mentor you through the business coaching, Karen. So no, maybe we can do a quid pro quo on that, because I've still got plenty to learn from you. But thank you so much for your time today,
You're
for your
welcome. It's been a
tenure.
pleasure.
It's been a journey, especially in which our times have interconnected and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do, in the macro, you are absolutely leaving as in a better place. And it's been really interesting in recent times for me to have a look in, and to certainly not to mark your homework, but essentially to look in at the organization and see the structural reforms of which you mentioned to me on air that I was oblivious to at that time. And so for me to now be on the inside, it's been really interesting and exciting to see. And I do think your living is in a good place. So thank you so much for all your efforts, and really enjoy your retirement.
Okay, thank you and good luck.
Cheers. Yeah.
Bye.
Are you tired of stick people drawings stinking up your exercise programs? Do you wish you had an exercise prescription software that had hundreds of pictures, videos, fully customizable text, inbuilt virtual consultation software, and you could send it by email or WhatsApp? If that software existed, I bet you would want a 3-month free trial, wouldn't you? Just go to rehabmypatient.com/physiomatters now